Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I think we'll find some good stuff to talk about today. We were eating tomatoes. I have to explain to you why we were eating tomatoes. I know I will have to explain this to some of you because you're probably still not eating tomatoes. If you're in South Alabama, your tomatoes are probably gone, particularly along the coast. From the garden I have, a little farther north of the coast, we're still getting tomatoes. And it's good, and that's nice. Now, I don't, there's no need to brag about that because I will tell you, my tomatoes started a lot later than most of your tomatoes along the Gulf Coast. But here's the thing, we were eating tomatoes. It's important to understand that we were eating tomatoes, and one of the people eating the tomatoes said, well, you need to talk about which tomato varieties you're interested in. I thought, well, I don't know if I really want to do that. I don't know if it's fair for me to talk about tomatoes in the middle of July. But I decided, okay, we're going to get over that. And then I'm going to think, well, now how am I going to tell people which tomatoes really, really work? And here's the fun part. Because we were eating tomatoes, and honest to goodness, I couldn't tell you which tomato it was we were eating at any one time. And there's a reason for that. And this is important. Because it's going to help to explain to you why I'm going to leave you with one thought. The freaks are the future. The freaks are the future. And here's the funny part. So I've been recommending all these tomatoes to you. And the tomatoes that I like the best are the tomatoes that are hardest to describe. Because every little tomato, it violates every rule you've been taught. Every rule that Walmart and Home Depot and the United States Army and every seed catalog has ever taught you. There was zero uniformity to those tomatoes. There were small tomatoes. There were big tomatoes. They were all the same from the same vine. It's true for all the tomatoes I really like. There's some important things about those tomatoes. First off, let me start out with the tomatoes by just saying this. I don't want you to forget about the freaks of the future, but I want to start off by saying, if you're going to grow tomatoes, and if you're really interested in developing a great tomato for a place like Mobile or Birmingham, you don't go to a place like Germany to get your tomatoes. I'm sorry. There ain't nothing wrong with being from Germany. There ain't nothing wrong with tomatoes grown in Germany if you're German. There's nothing wrong with Pennsylvania tomatoes if they're grown in Pennsylvania. If you want to grow an Amish tomato or some kind of special tomato with all of that branding on it, you go right ahead. But only if you live in those places, because those tomatoes were developed for life there. But if you were really interested in growing great tomatoes, you'd probably go to the center. Maybe we all should go back to the center of where tomatoes originated, which wasn't Italy. It wasn't Germany. It was the Americas. From Mexico south through Central America into South America. Lots of tomatoes there. Some people are going back and thinking, oh, maybe we ought to go back to where tomatoes got their start. Maybe. That's the future of tomatoes. So that's what I've been doing. I've been looking, and it makes perfect sense for us, if you think about it, because our conditions are far more like conditions in Central and South America than they are in Europe. So why aren't Central and South American tomatoes more popular? And I'm going to tell you why. It's because we have this weird idea about uniformity. It's everything has to be exactly the same. I think it's our obsession with branding. You hear people talk about branding all the time. You know, let's put a brand on this so people know exactly what they're getting. And the more you brand stuff, the more it has to be absolutely the same as the very last thing that you had. And I will be honest with you, Central and South American tomatoes, the ones grown, even the cultivated ones, are very hard to brand because there's a lot of variability within them. And everything you read will tell you that's a bad thing. You want absolute uniformity. You want every Cherokee purple tomato to look like every other Cherokee purple tomato you've ever had. Because we like that comfort of uniformity. But let me tell you, it won't work. It won't work in the garden. It won't work long term for all of us. And there's a lot of things to sort of unwrap here. I won't do it all today. But it's good to think about, because the freaks are the future. So let's think about what happens with it with a uniform tomato. If the tomato that's going to do really well in the conditions that I had last year, where it rained all the time, those tomatoes are going to do terrible this year, where I got very little rain at all. I got a whole nother set of diseases and problems this year than I had last year. Even year to year, it's a big deal. You want tomatoes that can adapt to different conditions. There isn't a single condition that tomatoes have to adapt to. So you want some variability, and you want some, here's a funny thing about scientists, and I work with a number of them. There is a point in scientists that scientists want everything to be very predictable. It's sort of what science is about, is sort of creating ultimate predictability, because it's a lot easier to measure. But life is hard. Things should be harder to measure. We shouldn't value predictability too much. But when they select for seeds, they're looking for, it is an obsession with people who select for seeds, scientists who select for seeds, that they isolate one particular principle, that they isolate one condition, and they keep it going exactly, regardless of what the other consequences are. And they don't want those plants to change. They actually actively work, as humans always have, to keep those seeds from ever having sex again. We won't talk about this too much on Sunday morning, but that's the truth. Your tomatoes, most of the tomatoes you have been selected so that they never have sex, so that we can prove that they're absolutely uniform, because we like predictability. But it's the future. The future is in the freaks, because year to year things change. Decade to decade, things change. Centuries to century, things change. And we need the foods. We need the tomatoes. We need the grains. We need the fruits. We need the roots that are going to be able to survive the changes in the future. And that's why I kind of like having non-uniform plants. I learn a lot from them. So can you. So, just something to think about next time you're purchasing seeds. If it seems a little funky, if there's a not pure uniformity, remember that your choices are coming out of that freakiness. Because what may seem not valuable today, not valuable this week, not valuable this season, may prove hugely valuable the next season, the next decade, the next century. So, what are my favorite tomatoes? They're the tomatoes that still trying to figure out what they want to be, that still have the capacity to figure out what they want to be. You'll have to do a little more selection. You'll have to do a little more thinking about it. But boy, I do like those tomatoes that did that. They were absolutely delicious. And I'll have to say, maybe not absolutely uniformly delicious in flavor, but all really good and all really variable in size. It's just part of what we should select for is the ability to be variable, the ability to have some freakiness intact. Freaks of the future of our garden. I got a lot to unwrap there, don't I? We'll talk about that this morning, but let's also talk about what's happening in your yard. What's happening in your fields. Let's talk a little bit about Alabama. Let's talk a little bit about the Gulf Coast. Let's talk about what worries you. We'll be back. 251-343-0106. You can call me. You can text me. You can send me pictures.
The mountain knows it's not in Iris or a wild rose, but a little flower of which I'll tell, known as Brave Coney Bell.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Welcome back. While the cat's got your tongue, I'm going to talk a little bit more about this thing that's obsessing me lately. And that is this idea that the freaks are the future. And I've been thinking about it a lot. I'm actually out collecting seeds, trying to figure out how do we save the shortleaf pine savannas of Alabama? How do we save the grasslands of Alabama? How do we save the sunflowers of Alabama? There's just incredible diversity out there that we give so little respect to. But it's important to save those things, not because it's important to Alabama, but because it's important to the world. And it is important to Alabama. But it's even more important to the future of North America, because Alabama is full of freaks. You don't want to hear that. But it's true. It's true. And they're pretty neat. They're pretty cool freaks. They're really interesting kind of things. Things that nobody else, we're still trying to figure them out. Because we have a very uniform idea about what an oak is, right? And we go out in the woods and we look and I say, well, that's an oak. And they say, oh, that doesn't look like an oak. Well, it is an oak, because we define oaks by this uniform standard that we created somewhere in Europe or somewhere else. And it doesn't apply in Alabama. It doesn't apply in Alabama. And so there are all these crazy things that Alabama has that, and in fact, you don't believe it, but it's absolutely true, that the rest of the country doesn't have. And they're going to need it, because things change from year to year, from decade to decade, from century to century. And so it's an interesting thing that scientists who often work on preparing seeds for gardens, for your yard, for your lawns, they're always looking for absolute uniformity. How do we guarantee absolute uniformity so that everybody knows exactly what they're buying and that everything is exactly the same everywhere? Walmart and Home Depot, I mean, they love Lowe's. I shouldn't be exclusive here. They love uniformity, because they want the same plant in every yard in North America, because it really works for their business model. But that's not how it works, because yards are different, because times are different, because things change, because you need variability. So here's a funky thing that scientists do, and it's very important. They decide, okay, well, here was our problem last decade. We had a problem in the last decade. How are we going to solve that? Let's create a new variety of seed that solves the problem we had last decade. Let's don't worry about anything else. Let's don't worry about the unpredictable. And let's forget about everything else. Let's make a corn variety that won't cross up with any corn variety, that has 0%, that has no potential for change. Tomatoes, heirloom tomatoes, are the worst of all, actually, because we have decided those tomatoes are static. We're not going to let them change at all. We're not going to let them have any ability to adapt to diseases or virus or insects or stink bugs or whatever other new problems we find or old problems there are in different places. And literally your heirloom tomatoes have very little chance of outcrossing, of actually being anything else exactly than what they have always been for, 50, 75, 100 years. And that's fine. But things change. And you got to be ready for that. So that's why I like my tomatoes to be non-uniform. And that's why I like my tomatoes from Central and South America, because many of them are still capable, fully capable, and do cross and reproduce. And that's something to think about. Having variability, having that kind of variability. You know, I'll also say that this comes back to that other thing we talk about a lot. Oh, it's a hard thing to talk about, isn't it? Diversity. We have to have it in our yards. We have to have it in our gardens. And if you live in a, you could probably get by without a lot of diversity if you lived in northern Canada. Because there aren't that many things that you have to adapt to. There's only one thing, which is the cold, at least right now. But when you move south, there are so many different things that will be working against you, that you need the diversity. That diversity is a buffer. It allows you to adapt to diseases. It allows you to adapt to other things. We need more diversity in our gardens and in our yards. So it's more than just tomatoes. It's all the other things that we really haven't thought about when it comes to what we could be growing in our yards, what we could be growing in our fields. A really interesting thing. You know, if you think about it, some people say, what kind of grass should I grow? And of course, I always think, God, what a great question. But then I realize that's not really the question they're asking. The question is, what kind of sod should I put in my yard? Which is a very different question. Because, gosh, I could talk to you about gamma grass and big blue stems and little blue stems. And I could talk to you about Indian grasses. And I could talk to you about toothache grass. We could talk all day about toothache grass. Please, somebody ask me to talk about toothache grass someday. What a cool thing. We could talk about all those things. But instead, we're talking about what happens on the sod in your yard, which was designed to be absolutely uniform. And we have all decided that modern lawns didn't used to be this way. I can guarantee you, because I've been mowing yards for a long time, they weren't absolutely uniform. And nobody really cared whether your yard was uniform, whether you had St. Augustine. Nobody said, what kind of grass have you got in your yard? And when I was mowing as a kid, nobody said that. I mean, you mowed what was there. Now, that may not have been the best way to treat your yard, in the sense that it would have been better for you not to mow it maybe for a while. But the fact of the matter is, uniformity has become more important in our yards. And the more uniform our yards become, the more susceptible they have become to disease. So some people say, well, just tell us what the best lawn grass is. I can't, because I can tell you that anytime I say that it is St. Augustine, or some new variety of Paspalum, or some new variety of whatever that they are creating on a massive uniform scale, I guarantee it's going to have disease and insect problems that will be uncontrollable eventually. There is no perfect single solution to a lawn. We want things to be uniform, but sometimes it's better to think in different ways, to think that, boy, you know, there may be better ways of thinking about a lawn that makes it more diverse, that allows it to have it more diverse. We could talk about lawns, and I'm happy to do that. There's a lot of new ways of thinking about it. Lawns are useful. It's kind of nice to have something that you don't have to think about, that you can just get on your mower and run round and round in circles on for a while. that may be the greatest use for lawns, is giving you an opportunity not to have to think about much. But as a matter of fact, if we're going to have great lawns, we're going to have lawns that are less uniform. That's the only way to do it. Kind of a fun thing to think about. How would you do that? It's not as hard as it sounds. It means that we would have to give the space in our yards not just to lawns, but to other cool things, like flowers, like vegetables, like maybe different kinds of grasses that don't all grow uniformly to 2 or 3 or 4 inches high. Maybe, what if we had some grasses that were really beautiful that got about knee high? Or maybe some grasses even that got waist high. Oh, there's some great ones out there, and they're incredibly beautiful. I don't think you can play golf in those grasses, but my bet is that most of you don't play golf in your front yard or your backyard. You don't need all that uniformity. You don't need that uniformity. Something to think about. Something to think about. So, Jason, thank you for taking the bait. Jason said, what is an Indian toothache tree? So this may be a slightly different question. There are a number of plants in Alabama that have the word toothache attached to them. There's a toothache tree that is native to Alabama. In fact, there are two species of toothache tree. And there's toothache grass. And we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about that. There is also a toothache tree in Asia, and we're going to talk a little bit about that because it's kind of cool. And it's something that I'm not sure it's so cool, I don't even think I fully understand why it is the way it is. But we're going to be back. We're going to talk a little bit about that.
The rain is falling through the mist of sorrow that surrounded me. The sun.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Rain on my face.
All right. Hasn't stopped. Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Lots of interesting questions this morning I'm raising and won't be able to answer fully, but they're interesting to think about. But this is a fun one. Can we talk about toothache trees, since I prompted you to talk about toothache trees, and it raised some questions, and toothache grass. This is a very interesting thing. It's one of those freaks of nature that we don't think about, but people in other parts of the world have. And Alabama has got these, really sort of one of our missed bets in Alabama is really understanding the herbs of Alabama and the wild herbs and how useful they are. There are three species in Alabama, at least, that have the word toothache attached to them. And it's not because they cause toothaches, it's because they relieve toothaches. And they do it very effectively. It's really bizarre. And I hate to focus on the toothache part of it, because they're really great to chew on just for the heck of it. It's really this remarkable experience. It's toothache grass, which is a beautiful grass. Every herb garden in Alabama should have toothache grass. You can't do it on a limestone soil, but if you live on an acid soil, you should have toothache grass. It's a beautiful part. It's a beautiful part of any herb garden, and a beautiful grass when it flowers. Flowering is something that is very special with these grasses. Once you see a mass flowering event of toothache grass, it's one of the most spectacular things you've ever seen. It's absolutely golden, unbelievably beautiful gold. As they send up their stalks, they have this weird flower. It is bizarre. It's bizarre at every stage. When it comes on, it's like it looks like teeth. It looks like a set of teeth. And I suspect There's a this makes for people who believe in the doctrine of signatures that plants look like the thing they're supposed to treat. Not really a great idea to follow, but toothache grass seems to confirm that idea because it looks like teeth. But very fine teeth, very pretty teeth. When the flowers come out, the grass is absolutely beautiful, beautiful clumps of grass. But if you chew on the tops or but particularly the roots of toothache grass, there's this wonderful sensation. It's like, you know, it's hard to compare things, but I would have to say that it is the flavor most resembles Dr. Pepper. Now, don't get too, it's not sugary. It doesn't have the bad aftertaste, but it's a kind of a pleasant pepperiness with some sweetness to it. Very nice to chew on. And then you're going to try to explain to somebody what this grass tastes like, and you're going to start talking, and you're going to lose your tongue because you won't know where in your mouth your tongue is. That's toothache grass. It's the coolest thing in the whole world. It's the best thing in the world if you're out in the woods with me, because you know that for at least a few minutes after I chew toothache grass, I'm not going to say anything. And there's a certain pleasantness to that, right? So there's some other things, too. Toothache trees. They do the same thing. And so I got to tell you about toothache trees. In China, when we talk about pepper in Chinese cuisine, Sichuan peppers, we're not talking about American peppers, not originally in those dishes. We're talking about the Sichuan pepper, which was a species of tree called Xanthoxylum, Xanthoxylum, however you prefer it. It is the Chinese version of our toothache tree, which I'm going to come back to. They've used it for years. They even have a name for the flavor. Now, I won't pronounce it, because if I pronounce it, it will probably come out to mean something like horse rather than toothache tree. But it's basically ma. And it means the particular kind of flavor you get from eating the fruits, the peppers, of toothache tree. It's an interesting thing, and it was a part of Sichuan dishes. It's a very important ingredient in Sichuan cuisine. Finally, we're beginning to see it show up here, because we would substitute American peppers for that, traditional peppers, the things we think of as peppers, those elongated things, which I love and are quite beautiful. We would substitute that for the true flavor of Sichuan cuisine. Now, they've been using this toothache tree for years and years to cook with. We have our own toothache tree. It has the same sensation. It's wonderful. And besides which, the toothache trees have this incredibly weird bark that looks like, oh, I don't know, it's like a stegosaurus became a tree. It's the most amazing looking thing you've ever seen. Very beautiful. The fruits are great. I love toothache trees. They're part of the Black Belt. We see them in coastal environments along shell mounds there. Another great component of our herb garden. Now, here's what's bizarre to me, besides the fact that folks in Alabama don't know what great things we have, these two very important herbs from Alabama. Here's what's bizarre is that the tree and the grass, which have no relationship with each other, I mean, goodness gracious. I mean, they had a very different evolutionary history, or however you want to look at it. They're just not even, and they have the same chemicals. And it's not just in ours, it's across the globe. There are a variety of these plants that seem to have this chemical that causes these sensations, or a series of chemicals. And they're all very interesting, and they're almost all used in cuisine or medicinally. It's one of our missed bets. So when we talk about an Indian toothache tree, we're very likely talking about one of those Asian toothache trees that's very similar to our own. And I suspect that Alabamians, if toothache trees catch on, and as the flavors that are associated with them catch on, I'm sure that Alabamian's first choice will be to go to India to try to find a toothache tree there, because nothing good could come from Alabama. But don't forget toothache grass. And don't forget Alabama toothache trees. Really cool things. There's the toothache story. Hope that helps. Michael, thank you for holding on while I was going through all that. What's up?
Hey, Bill, we just wanted to say we had such a wonderful time walking in the woods with you and listening to the show. You're talking about grasses. We were fascinated with the gamma grass that you were telling us about. So maybe if you're talking about grasses, maybe you want to tell us a little bit about gamma grass, and I'll hang up and we'll listen. Again, thank you so much for a wonderful walk in the woods yesterday.
All right. Thank you, Michael. So, yeah, we spent a lot of time walking around the woods looking at a lot of different things and floating around in rivers as well. But listen, gamma grass is another one of those great grasses we're missing out on. Let me just talk about it, because gamma grass is a first cousin to corn. Corn is a relatively recent invention. It was selected for by humans probably from some bizarre freakish event, because freaks are always the future. There was something that something weird happened to a gene in one of the relatives of gamma grass, and it started producing a slightly larger cob, but people kept pulling that tendency out, and the species wouldn't have survived if humans hadn't kept selecting it. But gamma grass was one of the ancestors, and as people are beginning to realize, oh man, we've selected corn to the point where it's lost a lot of its freakishness, it's too uniform, it doesn't have the capability to deal with the future. One of the things that people are coming back to are corn's ancient cousin, gamma grass, which was quite common across the South, really abundant. It was ice cream for cows, really incredible grass. It was one of those grasses. In fact, the problem with gamma grass was it was so good that people would just, you know, turn their cows out on it like they did in Europe, where they have a very different kind of grass, and they'd just leave the cows to eat. Well, the cows would eat the gamma grass up. There'd be nothing left. It wouldn't survive. And they wouldn't eat the other grasses that weren't quite as good, or the other forbs. And so one of the problems we had with gamma grass was that cows would eat it out because it was so delicious. Now, there's some great remedies to that, and one of them is thoughtfulness, something that's hard to come by at times. But in the old days, people would rotate their cows. And in the new days, people who are smart will rotate their cows. It helps everything. And even smarter people may think, God, there are other things in the world besides cows. But that requires a great deal more thoughtfulness, I suppose. And that won't quite eat out the gamma grass the way cows would. But yeah, gamma grass is great. So we've just about lost it. We now are using a European grass over much of Alabama, a number of European and African and Asian grasses that in many cases are very successful and easy to grow because they're toxic. That's bizarre, isn't it? So we're growing things like fescue in many places to feed cows, because fescue is very toxic to insects and diseases and other things, but it's also toxic to cows, and it causes close to $1 billion in losses in the cattle industry every year, and yet is the primary forage grass in the South because, well, it's too hard to change. And it makes a very uniform pasture. Oh, very uniform. But there's a problem with that, isn't it? So we want to reintroduce gamma grass, something we think could be really cool. And we'll kind of change the way pastures are done. The good thing about gamma grass is that we can even grow it in floodplains very well. Uh, and, uh, and it will help to control, instead of trying to grow corn, which doesn't grow well in some of those floodplains because you have to plant it so late because of flooding and other things, put the gamma grass there. It's really cool. One of these days, we're going to find other uses for gamma grass if we think about it. And we'll talk about that. Oh, we got lots of thoughts here. Thanks, Michael, for calling.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. So Jason said he got to try a toothache tree recently. And when he said Indian toothache tree, not the ones from Asia, but indeed it sounds like it must have been one from Alabama. Really cool. They're on the coast that quite a lot of them are under houses now, which is to say they don't exist. But you still find areas. I always, at the Dauphin Island Airport, down at the end of the airport, what a little airport it is, there's a bunch of it still growing there. You'll still find it on shell mounds and lots of places along the Gulf Coast. It's really cool, really cool tree. It's also in the Black Belt. It loves limestone soils. So if you live on limestone soils and you want that toothache tree flavor, that wonderful, inimitable toothache tree flavor, which is a flavor. I mean, it's not just a sensation. I mean, flavors are sensation. It's a combination of flavor and sensation, all packed in one. You can grow a toothache tree rather than toothache grass. It's neat. We can, anywhere you are in Alabama. But he tried it. It had this wonderful effect. It's more than numbing, though. It's not. It is kind of a numbing thing, but it's this wonderful tingling. It's like, it's not like a pepper kind of hot. It's like your mouth is sparkling. It's just this wonderful feeling. Everybody should try toothache grass at least once in their lives. And then you might want to try it more than once. Great, great plant for our yards. Something we should be thinking about more. And something that, one of those exports from Alabama that we've kind of missed over the years are toothache trees. We were talking yesterday about our herbs. You know, when we talk about herbs, we always think about, we're so stuck in Germany and France and Italy and England that we never think about herbs that grow outside those places. Not that any of those places are bad, but they didn't have much to work with. They didn't have much diversity. They had to import it from other places. And not much would grow in those really cold climates, where there wasn't much summer for the most part in the upper regions. But we got herbs all over the world, and we have our own herbs, and we never think about them, and we never exploit them. And I'm not out there to be a doctor and prescribe medicines to you, and I don't recommend that you do that, because you're probably not going to find anybody who's much of an expert in how to use our native plants as medicine. We lost that expertise 400 or 500 years ago, but boy, there's some great herbs for cooking with, and great herbs for smelling, and great herbs for all sorts of things that come out of the American woods, the North American woods, and from Alabama. So we should have a rule that for every, and I guess this is my rule. I think it's a very acceptable rule that for every time we talk about a lawn grass problem, we should also talk about grasses that are really fun to talk about, like toothache grass. So we've talked about toothache grass. So we are now open to talking about the problems that everybody is going to have with lawns, because lawns are, as I said, a bad idea. particularly at a large scale. And the larger the scale, the more of a bad idea it is, because it's going to be very hard to control. But if you look for uniformity, absolute teetotal uniformity in your lawns, you will drive yourself absolutely teetotally crazy, because you'll never achieve it. However, there are lots of weeds, and we can talk about how to deal with them. Here's a weed that I'm getting pictures of, and it's about time for me to get lots of calls about it, and I guarantee you there will be at least one picture a week, because people don't know what to do about it. It's Diodia. It's Virginia buttonweed. Virginia buttonweed, let's call it that. It grows in people's lawns. It's a native plant, kind of a cool native plant. Didn't used to be that common. But, you know, plants love our love of uniformity because they know how to exploit it. They know we're going to do something very predictable. They know we're going to go out and mow at just a certain height every time. They know we're going to apply extra water to make sure that our uniformity persists. And that's the very key that those plants use to wiggle their way into our systems. I think lawns with Virginia buttonweed in them are probably pretty healthy lawns, actually. Probably more healthier than other lawns, and it means that the grass that remains there can survive. But I will tell you, Virginia buttonweed will outcompete your grass if you mow shortly. If you mow too short, I guarantee you Virginia buttonweed will eat you alive. If you have centipede, you're kind of stuck, aren't you? One of the problems with centipede, I don't say that any grass is perfect. Centipede is just less perfect than others. But centipede is a little too short, so it's going to have tons of problems with Virginia buttonweed. If you have St. Augustine, mow as high as you can, and you will prevent Virginia buttonweed from becoming a huge issue. Mow about 4 inches high. Now, I'll tell you, you can go read any reputable website from a cooperative extension website run by real scientists, and they're going to tell you that there is no herbicide that will finish off Virginia buttonweed. It is very resistant to herbicides, and it's very hard to apply even the ones that work sort of well. There is a, because Virginia buttonweed's got us figured out, and it really has sort of figured out, oh man, these guys really love me because they're creating ideal conditions for me. They're gonna keep on. But here's the one thing that Virginia buttonweed hasn't figured out, and it's very easy to do. Virginia buttonweed hasn't figured out what to do if you simply bend over and pull it out of the ground. And what you'll find is that when you're getting a beginning infestation of Virginia buttonweed, if you spend 30 minutes, oh, I don't know, let's restrict it. Let's say you're going to spend, I hope you have a normal size yard, but in a normal size suburban front yard, if you spend 15 minutes a month, just lean over when you see that Virginia buttonweed come up. It's got those funky little leaves. It makes little things. It has little white flowers that look like a star with 4 points. White flowers. Just lean over. Get as close to the ground as you can and pull it out. Boom. It's amazing. It doesn't have time to seed. If you pull it out, don't just drop it, because it may have seeds on it and those seeds will germinate. Take it and put it in a place in the yard. Just make a pile of Virginia buttonweed. Put where your tomatoes are going. That's a great thing to do with Virginia buttonweed. Pull that Virginia buttonweed out, and where you're going to put your favorite tomato next year, just pile it there. Just keep piling it there. It'll die. It may have seeds, and the seeds will drop down to the ground. But you know what? You're going to have a mulch over it. And those seeds won't germinate because they need light to germinate. Kind of cool. And it really is probably going to make really delicious soil for your tomatoes. Probably as good as any mulch you could put there. Virginia buttonweed mulch for your tomatoes. That'll make you feel much better about the 15 minutes it takes to spend pulling it up. You're welcome to try any herbicide. You're welcome to find that none of those herbicides will really work. You're still going to have a large component of it left. Just pull it. Virginia buttonweed. We're going to be back. We got a top of the hour break, but we're going to be back. We'll be talking more.
Have a little song, won't take long. Sing it right once or twice. Oh, Lord, and me, didn't I shake sugary? Everything I got is done and gone.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. I hope you're having a good day. We've been talking about a lot of fun things about Alabama, and I'm thinking about a lot of FUD plants this morning. It was a great way to begin the discussion. Did we start talking about some grasses? We did, and I wanted to say a lot of you are going to see Virginia buttonweed. This is the bad side of grasses, which is long grasses. You will notice that we will never have a conversation about long grasses, which is about anything other than the fact that, yeah, it's got problems. It's always going to be that way because the idea of a lawn isn't in itself a problem. Now, lawns are useful. I have elaborated on the uses of a lawn. One, lawns are very useful from getting from one place in your yard to another. This is indisputable. If you've got a vegetable garden over here and your front door is over here, it's really nice to have a lawn to get from the front door to your vegetable garden. Great. Perfect. Just don't worry about what's in it. Just mow it. Just don't think about it. Don't put Bermuda grass in it. Bermuda grass, whatever we say. Because if you do, it's going to get into your vegetable garden, but just mow it and try not to think about it. If you and your brother want to wrestle, this is important. You need a lawn to do it on. But don't go overboard, because you don't take up that much space to have a good wrestling match, right? You're fine. I guess if you're going to play regulation football, which, you know, I know how old most of you are. You're not playing regulation football anymore. Don't build a regulation football field in front of your yard. All those things. Keep those things out. If you have to have a large lawn, get a horse. That's all I can say. I can't help you at those large scales, but lawns are useful at small scales. Just mow them. If you begin to get a few problems, and you will this time of year, with things like Diodia, Virginia buttonweed. It's a weed that has learned that we are creating uniform conditions that it can deal with, and it very predictably. We are so predictable. We have become so predictable that weeds know just how to exploit us. I can't fully cure you of your predictability, I suspect, if you insist on having a lawn. But that's okay. Recognize that there's a very easy way to deal with Virginia buttonweed. And it's simple. Pull it. Amazing thing, isn't it? Who would have thought you could pull a weed? And there won't be that many Virginia buttonweeds in your yard if you go ahead and get them when they first come in. And even then, I mean, we pretty well eliminated Virginia buttonweed. If you're irrigating a lot, you're going to get a lot of problems with Virginia buttonweed. You don't want to irrigate regularly. You don't want to be predictable about your irrigation. We can talk about that. Call me. We'll talk more about irrigation and how that creates weeds, because we create predictable situations. This uniformity thing, oh, it's a sad thing. It's a sad thing. Vanna, let's talk about that Let's talk about your sago palm. Tell me about it. You there? Vanna, did I lose you?
No.
Oh, yeah. I can't hear you. I'm listening.
Okay, is this better?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yes, it seemed to come rather suddenly, and I don't know what caused it. Certainly, it's not a lack of moisture. We've been getting rain, you know, like everybody. And not on all of the sagos, it's just on a few.
Yeah.
But that one particular one looked pretty significantly bad, so I don't know whether I should attempt to fertilize it. Does it need food or what?
Well, the good news is it isn't one of the bigger problems affecting the sagos now, but we do see this. I've seen this happening before, and it seems to be. So let me describe to everyone else what we're talking about, because I have the privilege of having seen the picture that Vanna took, which was a very, very, very good and telling picture. And what happens is that there is a yellowing in the center of the sago palm leaf. It's not at the tip, but it's a yellowing in the center. That I have seen that several times, and it seems to be some kind of nutrient deficiency. It doesn't seem to be associated with any scales. There's no scales in there, but there is something that interferes with the take up of nutrients, and you tend to get that kind of yellowing. It's probably, I have seen it described as a magnesium deficiency, and there are some supplements that you can add that over time seem to reduce that problem. I often see it in sago palms that are next to houses.
Yes, it's very close to the house, and so is the other two that have this same problem. Not as badly as this one has it, but...
Yeah, yes. And so nutrient uptake's a funny thing. Sometimes the nutrient uptake problem is in the soil, and the nutrients aren't in the soil, for example. And magnesium can be one of those things that can be a little deficient, and as well as some other minerals. But sometimes it has to do with the roots of the plant and their ability to move nutrients. And so if you're it's kind of like tomatoes with blossom end rot. If the plant has a hard time moving the nutrients from one part of the plant to another, I think you begin to see these deficiencies. And so when there's a lot of fluctuation in moisture, which may even do some damage to the roots, what we may be looking at is actually a nutrient deficiency that's a result of those fluctuations in moisture and maybe some damage to the roots. So I can't guarantee you that you're going to be able to cure it with some supplements like some and Vanna. I'll have to look up some sources and names for that, and I'll do it before the end of the show. But we may want to try some mineral amendments that you pour on, and it will take a while, and it may improve that. It could be that it grows out of it just because it's not having to deal with these wild fluctuations from extremely dry conditions to extremely wet conditions.
Right.
And so that in itself may cure it. Or it may be that sitting so close to the house where it's getting lots of calcium from the house and not a lot of magnesium, plus you're getting really a lot of moisture that tends to get pooled there because it has no place to drain, may mean that cycad always has a little bit of a problem. But let me give you the supplement and let's try it. Don't try to do it too fast. It'll work slowly. Before the end of the show, Vanna, listen, I will have a chance to look it up and give you the name of where to get that.
Thank you. Okay. Good.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Vanna. Yeah, so sagos. We're going to see some new problems with sagos because we decided that only one, we're pretty simple-minded sometimes, and we only had one sago. We brought it in, it became, and then not only we compound that by bringing in other diseases behind us all the time. So we brought in a sago scale that's really going to be devastating to sagos. And all the other problems, like the one Vanna and I talked about, probably will be insignificant as time goes on. But sometimes we do see problems on sagos that can easily be fixed. And this may be one of them. We'll be back.
Down to western Kentucky, where my parents were born. And there's a backwards old town that's often remembered so many times that my memories are worn. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise lay. Well, I'm sorry.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. The jasmine they smudged their word. Captain, now the ship is swimming.
Forgot my atomic table. Charlie, can you hear me? Yeah. So, sorry, we were talking, but we were having a hard time being heard. So, Vanna called, and about her sago palm in the last segment. And it's a really kind of an ugly little thing. The sago palm comes up, the sago palm is not a true palm. It's a cycad, actually, to be precise, from Japan. And the leaves are yellow, and they're yellow at the core of the leaf. The edges of the leaves are kind of green, and this is very, we see this a good bit. And it seems to be a nutrient deficiency. There are other problems, but this does not seem to be those other problems. This seems to be a nutrient deficiency. And I was very good to identify it as the nutrient deficiency, and I'm going to stick by that. However, I forgot my periodic table. Never forget your periodic table. And I called it a magnesium deficiency. It is not a magnesium deficiency. It is a manganese deficiency. Excuse me. So it's a peculiar thing to palms, and it happens when Vanna. This happens on palms often when the pH is very low, or when the pH is very high, or when there's some disturbance that prevents the palm from taking up nutrients very well. And all those things may be happening. I think that low pH is probably not a problem. I think the fact that it is surrounded by concrete suggests to me that the pH is actually pretty high there. And that may be part of the problem. So it's not uptaking. Normally that wouldn't be a problem except around the concrete. And so the plant may not be getting the manganese it needs because the pH is too high. You can supplement the pH a bit. We're naturally low in manganese in our soils. You can supplement it with a manganese sulfate. Let's make sure that I say this clearly. Manganese sulfate. So, Vanna, look for manganese sulfate, not magnesium sulfate. Switch your N and your G. Isn't that funny how they're so close? But they're not even the same thing. Manganese is very different than magnesium. Somebody thought they would have fun with us when they were developing the names for these chemicals. Kind of an anagram, I'm sorry. And so manganese sulfate is what you're looking for. Look for it on the web. There are several companies that sell manganese sulfate. Usually Agro South, I think, sells it, and you can order it. And don't rush it. Just put it on a little bit at a time. You can also find some palm fertilizers that have the supplement in there. But it doesn't look like you really need a lot of fertilizer on that palm generally. It just seems to be that manganese deficiency, manganese sulfate. There you go. So now we've got some other pictures that we need to get back to. Who was that that sent me? Abby. Was it Abby or someone sent me a picture of a vine? But the vine, which is fun to talk about, is pepper vine. It used to be Ampelopsis. Now it's Nicinius. I know you don't care about all that. It seems to be its own kind of thing. It used to be related. It's related to porcelain vine, if you know what that is. This is our native one, Nicinius arborea. It's a really cool vine. It's really beautiful. The berries are quite beautiful when they develop. The wildlife love the berries. The foliage is really very interesting and kind of nice. It's really this cool, cool plant. I see it all through the Delta. I see it all up and down our rivers. It's a really neat thing. It will eat your yard alive, I will tell you. You're not going to ever get rid of it. But it's, you know, when you see it, it can be difficult. If you've got an area where you don't really care and you just assume it took over, feel free. Chain link fences, great place to put it. It will always be prettier than the chain link fence. You will not see the chain link fence after a while because of pepper vine. Why is it called pepper vine? And I need to understand more about that because it does raise some interesting questions, right? Is it edible? Well, probably not in a conventional sense. The animals seem to have some types of creatures, like humans, seem to react to certain things different than animals do. The birds love it. Doesn't seem to bother them at all. But there is evidence that it can be a little excessively tingly for humans. And that may be because of our immune system overreacting to it in similar ways to the ways we overreact to poison ivy. It won't cause poison ivy-like symptoms if you simply touch it. Don't worry about that. But eating, maybe not such a great idea, not such a great idea on those berries. However, we do know that pre-Columbian used it for sore throats and other things. Does it work? I don't know. I haven't tried it. They didn't use the berries. They actually, I think they probably used the stems, chewed on the stems and leaves. I don't know. I don't suggest that you experiment with yourself, however, because there's a lot we don't know about Nicinius and a lot we should do. It's really quite a common vine, one of our unexplored Alabama natives, quite beautiful. Wildlife love it. It is aggressive in your yard, I will tell you. Comes up everywhere. It's a big vine. It's great on chain link fences. Nicinius is that vine, pepper vine. Now I'm going through trying to see who sent me that. I'm trying to figure it out. Another picture of an insect, which is a really cool insect. It's a very elongated orange insect. How do I describe this insect? It's really long. There's a lot of orange bugs out there right now, but this one's longer than most of them. It has three distinct areas of black on its back. The first one is it has a very long head. You'll see that it has black legs, a very long orange body, and then these three very interesting geometric shapes. One looks kind of like a little half oval at the top, and then one looks like a little notch below it that the oval's about to fall into, and then at the very bottom is a beautiful complete oval. Really, really interesting. That, if you'll look beneath his head, there is a little long proboscis-like thing, a long thread that's stiff. That is an assassin bug, one of many, a bee assassin, and they wait there for pollinators to come to those flowers, and then whop, they eat them. I have heard that it's possible to be nipped by one of those guys, but it's not likely. And they probably do as much good as anything for your yard. So just enjoy them. They're really quite beautiful. That's a bee assassin is the common name for that. I'm sure you wish I knew the genus name for it. I don't. I can't remember now. I probably looked it up before, but it's not coming into my mind. But I do know it's a bee assassin and kind of a cool part of a garden. Really a cool thing. What else have we got that I haven't gotten to here? Oh, Ted sent me a picture. He was in Eufaula, and he was there in late spring, and he has this beautiful flower, which looks like, what does it look like? It looks kind of like if you sat it right, it would look like a hoop skirt. We're going to come back, and we're going to talk about that flower, Ted. It's a good one. Good one to talk about.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, Jim, show me up, will you? So Jim sent me genus and family. I'm sure he's right on the bee assassin. Good. Yeah, you know, sometimes if you're quick, you can look things up, can't you? It works. But sometimes we don't have good keys for insects sometimes. And that's a problem when you're trying to figure out this huge diversity. So Ted sent me this beautiful picture of a mountain laurel. And I'm going to tell you, Ted, it's mountain laurel. It's Kalmia, whichever you prefer, name for, what's his first name, John Calm? I think it was John. Somebody Calm, K-A-L-M. And it's a very old plant. We think of it, you know, we say mountain laurel. And this irritates the stew out of me a little bit. And then we say, oh, isn't that weird that it's in that's in Eufaula? It's called mountain laurel. And then you're going to be down on a little stream in South Mobile County, and it's growing all over the stream, and you say, oh my gosh, it's mountain laurel in South Mobile County. And that it's at Mobile Botanical Gardens, and people think, oh, you planted it there. No. It's been at Mobile Botanical Gardens for longer than it's been at Mobile Botanical Gardens. It's been there longer than anybody ever thought to plant anything. In fact, mountain laurel, this beautiful shrub, beautiful flowers, really cool flowers. Calico bush was one of the old names for it. Poison ivy was another old name for it. If you ever see the name Ivy Creek, and you'll see that in many places in Alabama, you'll know that it has nothing to do with English ivy. It has to do with the fact that there's mountain laurel on that creek, because ivy was an old name for it. It's called poison ivy because when sheep ate it, it was a little toxic. And sometimes they, when they got desperate because they didn't have enough to eat, they would eat it, and poison ivy. Before we got the new poison ivy, names move around a lot. It's one of the problems with common names. But mountain laurel, calico bush, poison ivy, not poisonous to people, at least as long as you don't eat it. Beautiful, beautiful shrub. Flowers look like little hoop skirts if you turn them upside down. Really beautiful with these little kind of calico dots in them. They can be really pretty. Sometimes they'll be pure white. Sometimes they'll have a little bit of pink. And they've been growing in the coastal plain of Alabama for far longer than they've been growing in the mountains where most people go to see them. It's kind of ironic. So you say, oh, I'm going to come see the Mount Laurels in bloom in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and they are beautiful there. And the Great Smoky Mountains National Park is a great place to be, and you get to be with all those other people and all those other cars and all of that lines of traffic. It's so much fun. But let me tell you, Mount Laurel's been blooming in South Alabama far longer than it's been blooming in the mountains. We just don't recognize it. We don't cherish it. We don't protect it. We don't want to have places where people can go to see these things, I guess. But it's fun. It's beautiful, beautiful shrub. If you go to the mountains and try to bring mountain laurel back down to South Alabama, it's going to die on you. It has no tolerance. You can call it the same species, but it doesn't have that long adaptation. It's lost its ability to adapt to South Alabama heat. Whereas the plants we have from down here still have that ability. They don't dig up well. Please believe me, they don't dig up easily. Don't try digging one up because you're going to lose it. Because they're conservative plants, and that means they have gradually, slowly grown into this beautiful thing, and they don't like being dislodged because they just don't recover quickly. They're conservatives in the best sense. So it's a beautiful shrub. It's something we probably should grow more of, but nobody grows it much for South Alabama because it's called mountain laurel. So, of course, you can't grow it. It's funny. It's hilarious. Mountain laurel, cool thing. Cool and beautiful thing. Mountain laurel, Ted. Calico bush, if you resent calling it mountain laurel as much as I do. Or call it ivy. Just to be obstinate, just call it ivy. And then remember that it's named for a guy named Calm, K-A-L-M, Calmia, Calmia, whichever you prefer. Let's see, who else have we got that we haven't answered questions on? David, when David Hubble sends me a picture, I know I'm probably not going to have to answer a question. I'm going to learn something. And David Hubble has been working with that great, wonderful Caribbean vegetable that was once a part, when Mobile recognized what a Caribbean city it was, and when New Orleans knew what a Caribbean city it was. Melaton. Merlaton. Coyote squash, alligator pear, whatever you want to call it. David is the master of Melaton, and he's trying to resurrect the Gulf Coast strains of Melaton for use in gardens. And so one of the cool things he's doing now is to experiment with just extracting a sprouted seed and planting it. And it works well. What will be interesting is, will it work better than actually germinating that seed in the fruit? One of the interesting things about Melaton fruits is that traditionally you take the whole fruit and plant the whole fruit rather than just the seed. And the seed germinates inside the fruit, probably gets some nourishment from the fruit itself, probably keeps the seed a little bit moist, whatever benefits it has, but that's traditionally been the way of doing it. Does simply extracting the seed and planting it work also, or any better? Well, David's working on that, like he's working on many other really wonderful things that are going on. These are, it's so much fun when you ask me to identify pictures. This is a beautiful plant. So Jesse sent me this from Saraland. And it is one cool and beautiful plant. Jesse, hi, can you describe that for us? No, because you're not on the phone. But if you were, it's this beautiful purple flower that has all of these little, what do we call them, Jesse? Tubes? Tubes doesn't do it justice. They're little flowers. It's a cluster of flowers that are purple. And they all kind of come out in different ways in this sort of spray of smaller flowers. When you see that happening, the first thing you know, when you see a lot of flowers coming from one place, from one little cluster in a plant, you begin to think, oh, that's kind of how sunflowers are. But this isn't a sunflower. And then you think, oh, well, that's kind of like how asters are. And you're getting closer. It is in the family. It's in the sunflower and aster family. It's the composite family. This one is one of those composites that the South really does in a beautiful and incredible way. And we have more species than anyone ever thinks about. It's Liatris, Liatris, whatever you prefer. It's a beautiful native plant. It used to be called gay feather. That did not achieve much popularity. So now we call it blazing star, which really isn't, neither one is really an apt description of what we've got. We need better common names, but blazing star is one of the names. We have many types of blazing stars. This is one of those blazing stars, and I'm going to try to be good about it. I think it's Liatris squarosa. Maybe Liatris squarulosa. I'll have to think about which species it is, and maybe I can look it up, and next week I can come back. It's harder to do just with a picture. But it's one of the beautiful Liatris that is native to South Alabama. And just a great thing. Where did you find it, Jesse? It's was it in your yard? It's just a really cool thing. And what that tells me is that there's a remnant of the longleaf pine savanna still living there, still hiding out, still struggling to be seen, that we haven't mowed down yet. Beautiful thing, isn't it? Just a beautiful flower. What a beautiful Liatris squarosa, maybe squarulosa, but beautiful, beautiful Liatris blazing stars. Let's come up with a better name for that one. We'll think about it. We'll think about it. Another question, why are the leaves on my ahi peppers plants turning yellow? Ooh, that's an open-ended question. I'm not sure what to say just yet. I don't know. Is it? Are they getting too wet? Send me a picture. Let's look at it. You can text me a picture. Ahis are the peppers that, and let me know what kind of ahi, if you can. AJI, ahi. Some of you may know, we're kind of saying the world didn't begin and end with Mexican peppers, annuums. In fact, the real center of pepper diversity is a little farther south in Central and South America, and so we've been exploring some of those wonderful peppers that are Caribbean peppers and Central American and South American peppers that are not even in the same, they're not even the same species. They're entirely different things. They're bacatums. They're chinense peppers, which is the habanero group. But some of those habanero group peppers the in that species are actually quite mild. They don't have the heat, and that may be what you're growing. Some of the ahis are also referred to bacatums. Most of them refer to bacatum peppers from Central and South America, and I love bacatum peppers. I love bacatum peppers. Some of our friends had them last night, and they discovered that bacatum peppers have this beautiful, quick kiss. A little peck on the mouth. Say, ooh, and then it goes away. I love bacatum peppers. They have great flavors, and so do the chinense. Maybe more diversity in flavors from those. Why are they turning yellow? You know, I don't know, but I suspect it's a problem in the roots. So send me a picture, if you can, Shelby, and let me see what that's looking at. All you got to do is take a picture of the plant. All you got to do is take a picture of the plant, and let's try to figure that out, and figure out what's going on there. All right. Yep. We're going to break. We're going to be right back.
My Guguza, Guguza Bella, she's my pizza pie with lots of mozzarella. With Guguza, I wanna be, 'cause Guguza is so crazy over me. Guguzza grows in Italy. They love it on the farm. It's something like zucchini flavored with Italian charm. I call my gal Guguzza, cause she's sweet as she can be. She loves to hear me say, Guguzza, please, or botch me. My Guguzza, Guguzza Bella.
She's my pizza pie with lots of mozzarella.
With Guguzza, I wanna be. Cause Guguzza is so crazy over me.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. So trying to catch up on all the questions that we haven't gotten to. Vanna, just to be clear, one more time. Vanna, write it down. Manganese, M-A-N-G-A-N-E-S-E, manganese sulfate is the supplement you want. Southern Ag is the one that probably is going to have the product that you need. It's a specialty product. And, you know, it doesn't, sometimes it's hard to find. You can certainly try at some of the local stores around. They may have it, but you're probably going to have to order it on the internet, and it's available on the internet. You only need a little bit of it. You only need just a little bit of it. You don't need a lot. It used to be in a liquid form. I didn't see any in liquid form anymore. It seems like they're all in a powdered form, which is fine. You just mix it up yourself. Manganese sulfate, Southern Ag is probably going to be the place that has it. Shelby has several really neat ahis, Lemon Drop, Mango, Colorado, and Ahi Dulce. They're all great. Are they all turning yellow? Yeah, she's sending me pictures. We're going to look at it. Oh, it's in a pot. Ooh, that explains it. We're going to come back in just a minute. But first, I have neglected. We have a caller. I'm listening. Who's Tom? I'm listening. What's up?
Hi, Bill. This is Tom. I'm down in Josephine, Alabama. I have a question
yes,
about
sir.
Pros and cons of Zoysia versus St. Augustine. My lawn was pretty much destroyed by Hurricane Sally. I'm right on Perdido Bay with a bulkhead. And I don't know about salt tolerance. Thought I would ask your opinion.
Yeah. So, you know, please don't ever take a recommendation of one over the other as evidence that it's going to do well, because all lawns have problems. I just always have to say there is no miracle when it comes to trying to suit our appetite, our weird appetite for lawns. But let me say this. St. Augustine is probably more salt tolerant. It's not extremely salt tolerant. It's not as salt tolerant as, say, some of the paspalums that have been developed for those kinds of situations. But the paspalums have their own problems. So St. Augustine is probably pulled it out of little coastal margins that had brackish water. And it's probably a little more salt tolerant than some of the other grasses. Probably more salt tolerant than Zoysia, though Zoysia's probably better than some others, certainly better than Centipede. Which is better? I mean, there are a lot of other things you're going to have to worry about besides salt. One of the things I would do, and I'll give you this advice. Everybody always has a problem right on the margins with their lawns, right? You know, right where we intersect with this coastal environment. So in those areas, use the native plants that are already there to be a buffer to the salt. And don't try to build it up or anything. Just use those native plants. That way you get all the shrimp and the fish and everything else, and you don't have to worry about it as much. If it's inundated and the inundation is fairly quick, most lawn grasses will survive inundation from salt water. Your house may not, but the grasses will do reasonably well. But if I had to choose, I would choose St. Augustine. I would not put it on the margin between the marsh are the water but back it up just a little bit. Is that an acceptable answer?
It is. I've had some St. Augustine in the past, mixed with some centipede, depending upon what area. The St. Augustine tended to do pretty well. I've heard a lot about zoysia, and I just didn't know if that would be a better bet. But it sounds like stick with the St. Augustine.
Yeah, I mean, I think really the choice there between zoysia and St. Augustine is going to come down to the other problems associated with each of those grasses. You definitely don't want a dwarf zoysia. If you get a zoysia, you want a zoysia that you can mow as high as possible. There are many reasons for that, but I promise you will have a weed nightmare if you go with a slow-growing dwarf zoysia. St. Augustine is more aggressive and in growing and recovery, and that is a big benefit for St. Augustine because you're going to have some problems in that coastal environment. Zoysia, on the other hand, is more resistant to a lot of traffic. So if you're walking over this a whole lot, zoysia may be a slightly better match. Neither one is going to be perfect, and so you kind of have what you want to do. If it's a high traffic area, I'd go with the zoysia. If it's otherwise, I think I would go with the St. Augustine. Be prepared to mow it very high. I wish mowers would go up to 5 inches. If they did, people would have fewer problems with their St. Augustine lawns, with most lawns. They generally don't, but you want to mow it as high as possible.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that input.
Yeah. Good. Listen, let's talk quickly, Shelby, because we've got a little bit of time left. Shelby, I think your plants need some fertilizer. They need some fertilizer. Have you used some? Listen, I'm just going to make it simple and say Miracle-Gro, okay? It is very simple. It is very simple. Sorry for the pronouns there, Shelby. But listen, fertilizer needs fertilizer. I think that is the key problem here. They're also getting a little bit big for those pots. I think you'll be okay, but Miracle-Gro is simple. I don't mean to do one brand over another. There's nothing miraculous about Miracle-Gro. It's just going to be easy for you to use in containers, and they need something. They need some fertilizer, I can tell. So go ahead and fertilize them. Don't over-fertilize them. Just take it slowly. Build it back up, and I think those are going to do just fine. Somebody pointed out that magnesium sulfate, is Epsom salts, magnesium salts. But we're not talking about Epsom salts when we were talking about the palm issue. We are not talking about magnesium sulfate. We're talking about manganese sulfate. Excuse me. As I said, let's get that clear. Manganese sulfate, something else altogether. And we have just exhausted you and our time. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to be back next week. Save your questions up. Save your pictures up. I'll try to get to them all next week. Good to be with you.
Along about 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-ruttin' that Tennessee stud.